Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Spring and early summer is the usual season of wildfire in Alaska, and although we've not seen a big surge in fires so far this year, it's still early, and a few days of warm, windy conditions can dry things out quickly and raise the potential for unintended fires. How are beetle-killed trees adding to the risk of wildfire, and what are fire managers preparing for this season? We'll discuss the outlook for wildfire today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. If you're hurting in your relationship or have been affected by sexual violence, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a free 24/7 confidential and anonymous domestic, dating, and sexual violence helpline for Alaska Natives. Help is available by calling or texting 1-844-7-NATIVE or using the chat icon at strongheartshelpline.org. This message is sponsored by the Strong Hearts Native Helpline.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. How do Alaska land managers plan and staff for something as unpredictable as seasonal wildfires? Conditions can change within days, from ho-hum to a tinder-dry emergency with fires burning in several places at the same time. How has the fire season changed in the last decade or so in terms of length and intensity, and what's the outlook for this year? Here to help us understand what to expect and how to plan is Beth Ipson. Beth is the Public Affairs Specialist for the Bureau of Land Management, Alaska Fire Service. Also on the line is Cale Casey. Cale is the Public Information Officer with BLM, Alaska Fire Service. And Eric Stevens is with us. Eric is a fire meteorologist with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center, one of the coolest titles in the business, I'd say. Thanks for being here, all of you. And later in the program, we'll be joined by Monica Nicholson, a fuels specialist with BLM, the BLM Fairbanks District Office. You can also join us, Alaskans. Have you been taking steps to ensure your property is as safe as possible from fire? If not, what questions do you have about how to do so? Are you worried about the growing number of beetle-killed standing spruce trees and how that affects fire danger? Or do you have any tips to share for prevention? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. Beth, I want to start off with you. There was a tundra fire near Kwikset last month that was the largest in 25 years for that area. What's going on? Is it still being monitored at all, or is it considered completely out?
Well, that was actually a state-managed fire, and that was the largest fire for this early in the season. I don't want to necessarily say it's the largest fire for that area. We do have a lot of tundra fires.
That early, yes. Thank you for that clarification. So early in the season, yes.
No, that's no worries. And I think it's around 25 years, largest early tundra fire for 25 years. As far as I know, it's still in monitor status, but what's really not unique is that we do have the propensity to have tundra fires because you know, the area is snow-free, the tundra is, right, the tundra grass is very dry, and it's pretty susceptible to a fire start, you know, likely by human, you know, something to do with humans. So, you know, while that was certainly a large fire, it, you know, it gets rare for this time of the year.
April is one of Alaska's driest months, but were there other factors that aided in that fire spread? And you know, I understand that that was, as you mentioned, a state-managed fire, but what do you know about that?
I'm going to defer to Casey, or Cam Casey, because he actually was more involved with that fire than I was.
Oh, great. Okay. Hi, Cale.
Good morning, Lori. And just one correction there on my title. I do represent the Department of Forestry Information, but as Beth from BLM and I know, we work hand in hand on fires. Out here in Kwikset, it was just very dry, Lori. The interior Alaska had almost record snowfall. Kenai and Matsu Borough had great snowfall, but Southwest Alaska did not have the same depth of snowfall. So April winds, we had a dry spell, and boy, that fire just kept jumping those little frozen creeks. And the aerial observationist, Matt Snyder, did a fantastic job flying the fire 6 times over 10 days, sending in those photographs. And we got to show Alaskans how persistent that fire spread was. It just shows you how quickly the grasses, bushes, and brush just dry out in the absence of rain. And that's what we're experiencing right now in the Kenai.
Well, let's talk a little about that. My apologies, Cale, for getting your title wrong. You're the Public Information Officer for the Department of Forestry and Alaska Fire Service. Is that correct?
Division of Forestry.
Division.
And then Alaska Fire Service is going to be BLM. I know it sounds confusing, but what we want Alaskans to know is that we all work together. We right. truly do. The Facebook pages, we team up together to get the information out, because the smoke jumpers are Bureau of Land Management. And there are also Bureau of Land Management hand crews and crews, but then there are state forestry crews. So we all just work together. We respond together. That fire down at Cooper Landing last week was a great example. Local, county, state, everybody, sorry, borough, state, everybody on the same fire at the same time.
Well, all right. So here's a question for both Beth and Cale. Where are fires burning currently in the state?
So right now, mostly we have fire starting in South Central and a few in the Kenai Peninsula, and they're mostly human caused fires. You know, whether it's a debris pile burn that's got away from, you know, the person that was monitoring it, you know, you get a little wind on it and you know, the embers land in the dry grass nearby and it spreads. So right now the main factor in these new fires are that they're human caused, and you know, there's a burn permits. Forestry has a burn permit program, and what's great about the burn permits is that they have a lot of great instructions on them. You can download it off the website, the forestry burn permit website. You can go, a lot of times the fire departments, the local fire departments have these burn permits, and if you follow the instructions, that's really a really good way to keep your burning, you know, whether it's a burn barrel or a.
Oh, Beth, are you still there?
Debris.
We lost you for a second.
I'm so sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yep, sure can. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, it's very important that you follow that, because you are responsible for every fire you start.
Well, and you mentioned a couple of times that these are human caused. Is that because it's too early for lightning strikes, or is there evidence that was found that shows it was, you know, a burn pile or something that got out of control?
Yeah, usually when we have response show up, there's a homeowner that they've talked to, and there has been some lightning recorded throughout the state, but it's not very much.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing the wildfire season. We have on the line with us Beth Ibsen, the Public Affairs Specialist with the Bureau of Land Management, Alaska Fire Service, and Cale Casey is with the Division of Forestry. Also on the line is Eric Stevens, a fire meteorologist with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. So are there areas, you mentioned that there's some fires in South Central and on the Kenai, Are those the most concerning areas of the state right now? Are they considered the driest, or where are you really keeping an eye across Alaska?
Right now, Lori, the Kenai, certainly Kodiak, that's where we have the burn permit suspension, and those fire management officers and those areas evaluate that daily. So it's easy for Alaskans to track where the danger is going to be by looking at that burn permit suspension. You can still have campfires that are attended out when you're camping. You can still do those kind of recreation responsibly fires. But right now, that's where we're seeing the grasses have the most potential to carry an escape fire into somebody's shop, into vehicles, into houses. We know that that happens in Alaska, so we're on high alert in those areas.
Do you work with, I'm not sure who, if it's, there's the municipality of Anchorage has its own crews that work on fire mitigation for the municipality, but do you coordinate with those folks or work on mitigation efforts within the municipality? And the reason I ask is I use the trails every day, and there are tremendous numbers of dead standing spruce throughout the parks. And although I've seen some brushing done of chokecherry trees, young saplings that they're cutting down and brushing, you know, 10 feet away, there's standing dead spruce trees that are a much higher risk of fire than these young saplings. And they're not, those aren't being cut down at the same time. So understanding that that's not probably your area of expertise, do you have some ideas about what the plan is for those areas within this intense urban setting? There's also a lot of dry, dead standing grass in a lot of those areas, too, that's tall and definitely some robust fuel potential.
Well, Lori, good question. And we had a really wonderful Firewise Council at the Hilltop Ski Area a couple weeks ago. And Carmela has an organization there, one of many in the Muni who are addressing exactly what you're talking about. There's a known hazard fuel problem in the Muni. There's a known people who start fires by accident that could spread really quickly into areas that are very hard to get out of. So Anchorage Fire Department is working very intently on bolstering their wildland fire program. And Lieutenant Davis spoke in depth and passionately about that at Hilltop, the recognition that all 300 plus Anchorage Fire Department firefighters are becoming wildland trained or retraining if they trained in the past. They want to be much more robust in their response. And the hazard tree situation, the private contractors are very engaged. There are old fuel breaks that need attention. Lieutenant Davis mentioned that quite a bit. And of course, funding for the Muni, there can be programs. It depends on where you are. So people need to check with their own fire station locally. That was the Anchorage Fire Department advice. Please call the station, get an assessment, have somebody come out, have that conversation now and get those assessments done in your area so you can figure out how to better protect your home, make sure that you're doing proactive planning with your neighbors, that you're looking at how to get people out, the elderly, your own pets or animals or whatever you have. But it is a watch out situation. And Matsu area is responsible to respond and support and take over the Muni fires. So just so everybody understands, Anchorage Fire Department will be first on scene. Initial attack will come from Matsu and Joint Base J-Bear, and then the transfer command will happen to forestry.
All right. Thank you for that. Eric, I want to get you in here now. Thanks for your patience. As a fire weather meteorologist, describe your work. Are you focused on or working to predict weather conditions that elevate fire risk?
Certainly, weather is one of the big drivers of wildfire behavior. And I view my job, yes, as making meteorological decisions. The most important aspect, though, is to communicate the relevant aspects of the forecast scenario to the wildfire decision makers, the crew bosses and such, so that they can do the best job and operate the most safely they can out there on the fire line. When we do our jobs right, you know, fewer people die and fewer American dreams go up in smoke. And weather, fuels, topography, they all play a role in fire behavior. And weather is a thing that can change on you real fast. And so I do try to communicate those aspects that can be important on the fire line, like a wind shift that's coming up, or perhaps very dry air is moving in, things like that, that matter immediately here today for the firefighters. And then a few days out, even a week out, to do planning for bringing in additional resources, such like that. So meteorology, not for meteorology's sake, but rather to make the wildfire mission more effective.
All right. Thank you for that. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions or comments, you can join us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Eric, some of the massive fires in the lower 48 in recent years were reported to be so enormous and intense that they created their own weather. Talk about how what's happening there.
Right. Well, in those situations, the fire behavior is called plume dominated. And that is, warm air will rise, so the fire produces hot air at the surface, also, believe it or not, releases moisture into the air. This will ascend, and if conditions are right with the overall weather, that fire can be the triggering mechanism for a thunderstorm development right over the fire. In that sense, the fire did contribute to making its own weather. And those situations are dangerous because the inflow winds into the base of that building cumulonimbus cloud, a pyrocumulonimbus, those winds can be very changeable and they can get very strong, changing the environment on the fire line in very short time. That kind of plume-dominated behavior is more difficult to come by in Alaska than in the lower 48, but you can't rule it out here either.
And is that for folks that have burned firewood, they understand, you know, what the chimney effect is. You warm up your chimney, it helps create the draft that pulls the smoke up and away. Is that similar to what's happening with massive fires, where they're sort of creating their own kind of a chimney effect and just sucking air up and pulling that fire with it?
That's exactly right, Lori. The updraft in the storm creates a vacuum down at the surface, and so air rushes in to fill that. It is, I think that's a good analogy, a chimney effect. Mm. Here in Alaska, the weather that is most threatening at this time of year, because the grasses are dry, and that's the wind-driven fires. When we have a dry, windy day, even if it's not particularly hot out, those grasses, they're left over from last year. They're all brown and dried out. They're just looking for an excuse to burn. And, you know, I might touch back. We were discussing earlier the Kwikliq fire in southwest Alaska and the fact that it's been dry there here in the spring. Also, one factor we need to consider as well, and this has the specter potentially of climate change, is some of the precip that did fall over the winter when things were not in a state of drought. The precipitation was a little more rain than snow compared to what you might call normal. And this has been, you mentioned the lower 48 states. In California, one of the concerns is, what if the wintertime precipitation that usually falls as snow in the Sierra, what if the atmosphere is a little warmer and some of that snow now starts to fall as rain? That means you don't have that snow available at this time of year in the spring to melt off. And perhaps that is a factor in Alaska we'll need to pay attention to, wintertime warm rain events, like we saw at Christmas in Fairbanks in the interior this year, between Christmas and New Year's. That could change the amount of snow available in the spring while leaving the overall precip the same. So do we get rain? Do we get snow? That's a factor as well. And boy, here in 2022 in the spring, the interior has plenty of snow still on the ground. Got to get rid of that, melt that snow before you open the opportunities for the fire season to start burning those old grasses. And then as the season progresses, the warm air affects the ground, begins to dry out and warm up that subsurface layer. And that's by the time we get into June and early July, that's when we really have the weather that can push fires aggressively.
We, speaking of snowpack, we certainly had heavy snowpack in South Central. And that's always good for packing down those dry fuels. But it sounds like, Eric, there's a need to also get rid of some of that based on what you were saying about those dry grasses and things. Now that things are greening up, does that help alleviate some of that worry? And maybe this is a question for either you, Eric, or Beth or Kale, but does that help in green up, or is it a situation that can change in a matter of days depending on temperature?
You know, the one thing I'll say that's related here, Lori, and we get this question every year in the spring. What does the winter snowpack that's on the ground now and it's going to melt, what does that imply for the upcoming wildfire season? This year, we've got a lot of snow on the ground and it's hanging around later than usual. We've had a cool spring. We have looked into this, and believe it or not, it's kind of like the stock market, that past performance has no indication on future returns, that the winter snowpack really, once it's gone, the fire season will behave according to more immediate forcings. So once that snow is gone, it's pretty much forgotten, it seems. We've tried to find a correlation, and there just isn't one. So that's what I'll chime in with for the impact of the snow and the melting on the fire season.
Interesting.
But yeah, Beth and Kale, certainly feel free.
Well, and yeah, well, go ahead, Kale.
There's just no doubt that at least where I live in the Mat-Su borough and south, that the conditions change so quickly. I'm at mile 7-3 in Willow. You go down a few miles, it's much more dry. You go down to town in Wasilla, oh my gosh, it's been dry for 3 weeks. So people who leave Talkeetna, Caswell, who drive down to Mat-Su or Anchorage are amazed at how quickly things change. And that's day by day by day. I mean, sunset past 11 now. The winds, I believe last weekend or two weekends ago, I was getting texts from all the prevention and hotshot saying, boy, this feels like fire weather. There was a north-south wind blowing all the way down across the Muni. I bet you felt that down there, Lori. It was one of those days where firefighters start getting that hair on their arms and neck standing up saying, oh my gosh, today's the day that if somebody makes a mistake, this wind's going to carry it through whatever it can. And it changes so fast. So for folks listening at home, we're in that window now where it's going to be just a matter of time. We've had 74 human-caused fires out of the 84 wildfires this year. So think about those percentage points. We're going to see a human-caused fire go into a structure or community any day now. So people have to be very, very, very alert as these 70s arrive midweek, later week here. That is fire weather.
Yeah, absolutely. As you noted, it can change so quickly in a day or two or just in several miles. So, Kale, against that backdrop, how is the staffing situation for firefighters this season in Alaska? Has your industry seen hiring shortages similar to what we're seeing in others?
Good question, Lori. Alaska has traditionally had a smaller pool of firefighters compared to, let's say, lower 48 states. We have definitely depended on the lower 48 hotshot crews to come up here in big years like 2019 and 2015. Alaskans will recall that we've flown up thousands of firefighters in those years from other geographic areas that right now might be in their deep fire season. So Alaska's got a very similar number of resources that it's had. The hotshot crews are ready. They're out there cutting fuel breaks right now. Gannett Glacier just got done with its training out in Palmer. They're out there cutting fire breaks right now. We have our smoke jumpers in Fairbanks ready to go. They're already jumping fires. It just went out the Aleutian the other day. Our air tinkers are in. We have the house bill that's going to help us hire more EFF crews to do more mitigation work. But really, when the fire season hits, we depend on lower 48 resources. So that's going to be one of those interesting alignments for Alaska. Will we get the resources if and when we need them in the numbers we've had in the past? Because that depends on all those mega fires down in the 48.
And last year's fire season in Alaska was, I guess you could say, relatively normal. But in the lower 48, the ongoing drought has hit so much of the western U.S. Were Alaskan firefighters down helping out? And do you think that that will happen again in this season?
Yes. This is Beth. That happens pretty much every season. And that's one thing that we do a lot is that we have, because we're trained on with some of the same qualifications and the same structure, that we're able to seamlessly, a lot of times seamlessly insert into different positions, whether it's up here or in the lower 48. But we typically have help from the lower 48, and we reciprocate that when our season winds down somewhere around, you know, mid to late July. We can free up some of our resources to go down a little bit. Now, 2019 was certainly a little different. I know there's probably a lot of people that remember that fire season where we had fires that were staffed at end of April, and the Swan Lake fire was still had people assigned to it the end of September. And fortunately for us, the fire season lower 48 did not really pick up. So we were able to get quite a few crews up here and for the length of the summer. I talked to some members on hotshot crews, and it turned out that their only fire assignment for that entire fire season, entire year, was in Alaska. Some crews came up multiple times, and thank goodness we had those resources. We were able to get them come up because, if they had a fire season, I don't know. It would have been a bigger challenge. So yes, every year we definitely see people come up and we send people down.
All right. We had an email question from a listener in Eagle that says, a much needed shaded fuel break fire mitigation project was scheduled for this spring in Eagle. The shear blade portion of the project was appropriately scheduled for next winter. Re-clearing our present community fire break is also part of the grant. And they write, a reliable source has shared the spring work may be postponed due to a bird nest count. Understandable and important, but can you clarify when this spring work will take place? The longer we postpone, the greater risk of losing available crews to do the work. Any insight into that, or is that something that's outside of all of your expertise?
I can address it to some degree, and Monica may have more knowledge of that when she's joining us later, but the Village of Eagle, they have really taken a hold of some funding. There's a process, and like I said, Monica could help out with the process, but they have been able to establish some work and get some fuel breaks around the Village of Eagle. The community of Eagle, there, and I think she's talking specifically to BLM managed land, and we are working. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. There's studies that need to. There's researchers that go out and make sure that, the wildlife isn't going to be disturbed to a degree. And they've with this, it's the migratory. There's some migratory birds, and the work cannot be completed after a certain point because of the migratory birds. But I don't have an update on that, but that's certainly something that we could look into more. But I can probably reach out to that person afterwards with some more information.
Okay. Well, we'll make that connection. Thank you very much, Beth.
Thank you.
So there's a wildfire smoke prediction map that UAF maintains. It's kind of cool to take a look at that and see where there are fires. Yesterday, the map showed that there were less than 20 fires burning, most of them small and in South Central. There's one near Fairbanks, also small, and then one large fire on Adak Island. What's known about the Adak fire, and beyond that, is it good to be a little more than halfway through May and only have a handful of small fires, or does that tell us nothing? Beth, do you want to take that, or Kale? Go ahead. Sorry.
I just spoke to Sam about that fire. The jumpers worked it a couple nights, and they were able to catch it. Right now, Lori, we really are on a day by day with this weather that's coming up here. So when we talk about coming out of winter into alignment, we are into alignment right now. So as a fire community, we are, like I mentioned earlier with the Kenai issue, we are on high alert. We're not gonna, like Eric mentioned it perfectly, the stock market, the value of about the winter snow and all that, it doesn't matter anymore. It's about the wind, it's about the sun, it's about human factors all aligning and the Swiss cheese effect that could start the early season fire that takes out a few homes or even worse, really hurts or injures somebody. So this are here Tuesday morning, May 17th, 10:28 a.m. It's on. This is the beginning of us really being on a high alert for initial attack. The state and feds move all the resources around the state to meet those priorities, whether it's heli-attack crews or, for example, a couple weeks ago, the White Mountain crew was moved out of the interior down to the Kenai because the interior has all that snow. They wanted them in a better position. And as they drove down, they picked up that fire near Cooper Landing and were able to work that Kenai overlook right on the spot, being diverted from their first night of actually being on the Kenai. So we're moving resources into position because this is the time.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Monica Nicholson, a fuels expert with the BLM Fairbanks District Office, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. NEA Alaska members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org and help NEA Alaska reach, teach, and inspire all Alaska students. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking today about the wildfire season. And if you were listening before the break, you heard Cale Casey, who is a public information officer with the Division of Forestry, talk about how now is the time. Everyone is on high alert. All the folks who are monitoring these conditions and are staffed up and prepared to fight fires are definitely on high alert because things are quite dry in South Central. And so please be very, very careful out there when you're doing any kind of outdoor activities that could result in a fire. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide if you have questions or comments. 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Before we bring Monica Nicholson in to talk about her work as a fuel expert, Cale, I want to back up just a bit to the fire on Adak Island. What's known about that fire?
So the fire on Adak Island, like I said, the jumpers flew out there. I think they had to have two fuel stops. Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, so actually that was a different fire. That was near Sandpoint. The ADAC one, it was, I believe it was reported after the fact, and it didn't garner a response from firefighters. You know, sometimes when you've got these early season fires, they burn through the grass and they kind of burn themselves out. So there's not a lot that we know about this fire because it didn't really generate a response on our part. But the other fire that he was talking about, referring to, was the Dead Point fire near Sandpoint, which is on the Aleutian Chain as well. And we did have 8 smoke jumpers respond to that. And it was burning in some really steep terrain. So that was that they were able to kind of confine it. And then it was put in monitor stacks.
All right. Well, thank you for that update on that. Let's bring in Monica now. Monica Nicholson is with us. She's a fuels expert with BLM, the BLM Fairbanks District Office. Monica, talk about your work as a fuels expert. What does that mean? And how do you help the public know what they should do to help them protect themselves and their property from wildfire?
Hi, yeah, thanks. My name is Monica Nicholson. I work for the Fairbanks District BLM, and my role at the Fairbanks District BLM is basically to help plan fuels projects around Interior Alaska affiliated with BLM land. and help folks in communities also initiate and plan for projects themselves. So things that I really like to encourage communities to do, and this can be done on any level, whether it's a village community or at a borough level or a city level, town level, community can come together and create a CWPP, which is a community wildfire protection plan. And what that basically is as a community, folks can come together, kind of assess the situation in their community. They can look at what they themselves would like done in the community as far as fire protection, and that even extends to needs such as fire equipment, fire department needs, that kind of thing. And then also just take a look at like what kind of fuels reduction projects they could do around the community and what they would like to see in terms of fire protection around their community. And once a plan like that is complete, then part of my job would be I can help allocate some federal dollars, some federal funding to help execute those plans in the communities, help allocate money for supply needs so folks can prepare the communities for wildfire. And so that is a large part of my job. As far as interacting with communities go, and then as far as carrying out fuels projects on Bureau of Land Management land, I plan for those, and then I help execute them when the time comes.
Have you, I don't know how long you've done this work, but have you observed changes in the type and abundance of fuel of concern for wildfire in the time that you've been making these observations?
Yeah, I'm actually fairly new to Alaska. I moved up here last year, but I have been doing fuels management work for almost 23 years now in the lower 48 in various places. And there are some very key differences, of course, between Alaska and the lower 48. And there's also some differences in the amount and availability of fuel now in 2022 versus 20 years ago. As you know, we all know, the more we exclude fire on the landscape, the more fuel accumulates. And so Alaska is actually very unique in the sense that we do have the ability in many places in Alaska to let fires burn as they would naturally, and we can manage them at different levels. And that's very different from the lower 48, where in the lower 48, we've seen an obvious accumulation of fuel due to fire suppression for the last 100 years. The difference, the main thing I'm seeing in Alaska now is that the fuel type is a very consistent, uniform fuel type of mostly trees. And when the fire moves through the trees, it moves straight through the canopy. And it really doesn't have any means to stop until it hits a barrier meaning like a river or a break in the trees, which would come from an actual community. So when I'm looking at fuels and their impacts to communities, I look at how consistent is that tree in that canopy layer as it comes up to the community. Like, is there anywhere we could stop the fire? Is there anywhere that would naturally stop the fire? And if not, then the treatment planning here in Alaska is very specific to areas immediately bordering communities where we can remove fuel to lessen the impacts of fire or have a place where we can stop the fire. And that's a very different strategy than is currently occurring down in the lower 48, where they're trying to treat on a larger scale basis thousands of acres for various reasons to return kind of the fire return interval to its natural state back because we've suppressed fire so much in the lower 48. So Alaska is definitely a more community-based approach. It's very specific as to where we're putting these treatments, and it has a very specific purpose.
Well, as you probably know, even though you haven't been here for very long, there's a lot of folks that live remotely. And we have an email from Mary who says, what is the best action to take now if you live in the woods and can't afford to have the big trees cleared around your home? She says, I see most of my neighborhood has homes with big trees right up to the cabins and houses, and it's very expensive to clear these. She says, thanks for all you do for Alaskans. But what mitigation efforts can someone in that setting take?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of various different actions one can take, and I will actually refer folks to look at the FireWise website and look up defensible space, perhaps on the internet, if you just search those words, defensible space, it'll give you a lot of ideas as to what you can do as a homeowner, as a property owner, to help yourself out. And it is not always related to tree removal, especially, you know, you want to look at the size and characteristics of the trees, and they may or may not be a direct threat to your home. There's other things you can do, like clearing gutters, removing the ground fuel away from your home if you have a bunch of needle litter or forest floor litter around your home, clearing that. Wood piles, I know most of us here in Alaska, myself included, have, you know, cords of wood stacked near the house for wood burning, and that's a major receptive bed for embers from a fire that we want to distance, if we can, from our homes. So anything like that could basically be a receptive bed for an ember you want to take care of. And also looking at the type of roof you have on your house. Do you have litter accumulations in your roof? Is your roof made of wood? Is it made of metal? That kind of thing. And then just the general layout of your property. Do you have propane tanks? Do you have other things that will contribute to, you know, a high intensity fire near your home? So it's not just trees, especially in the urban areas. It can be a variety of other factors. And then also the other thing I like to stress for people is just access to your home. If and when the time came for folks to get in and try to save your home, you want to make sure that your driveway provides good access and turnaround, or, you know, is it cluttered? Can people even get in there? I mean, that's the number one reason. That's the number one thing firefighters look at when they go in to even assess the home is, can we get in there safely? So I just encourage people to keep their driveways plowed, keep them clear, keep them safe for emergency responders.
As I was looking at some information, researching for this program today, I found this, the 5 P's of immediate evacuation. 1 was people and pets and other livestock. 2 is papers, important documents. 3 is prescriptions, pills and eyeglasses. 4 was pictures, irreplaceable memories. And 5, personal computer information on hard drives and disks. So I thought that was a nice, succinct way to put it, the 5 P's of evacuating if you have to get out quickly. So, and Monica, this maybe is a question for you, or it could be Kale or Beth could answer too, but I remember when Tim Mowry was still working in this capacity, we had a discussion about activities that people should be careful about that can start a fire, and they might not think about it or realize it's a combustion risk, like hot chainsaws on dry grass, ATVs, target shooting, and sparks from motorized off-road vehicles. Tim told us a story about somebody starting a pan of Jiffy Pop on fire and throwing it off their deck and starting their deck on fire that way. So what are some of the activities that people need to, especially as Kale said, right now everyone's on high alert. So what are you warning people about being careful about when they're outdoors?
Yeah, Tim's always good for a good story. He's always good for a good story like that. But even driving on dry grass or parking your vehicle on dry grass, you have that hot exhaust pipe, or even your catalytic converter can kind of collect some grass debris in there and start a fire. It's pretty amazing, especially now before green up. In green up, we have more moisture that will be in the vegetation, that the green grass will come in, and we'll have leaves on the trees. But right now, you know, it's really a careful time. You know, the gun range, we have fires that sometimes start around gun ranges. It's good to have the grass and the kind of that leaf litter cleared from gun ranges, and also be careful about what type of rounds that you're using. Also, don't use explosives, because exposing targets, because that can, of course, start fires as well.
And do you also recommend that people, either if they're going to be doing brush clearing or things like that, that they do that either early in the morning or later in the evening when there's more potential for some dew and a little more moisture in the air? I know I was clearing some dead grass behind my house a couple of summers ago that was very, very dry. And it was during the heat of midday, and I had to stop because the weed whip that I was using, I could smell the grass starting to smolder a bit. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to start a fire trying to prevent a fire. So do you have recommendations about that, about a better time of day to do some activities than others?
Yeah, Lori, absolutely. Right now, it's really important that folks go along with what we're telling them, which is please just be hyper aware, wait for there to be moisture if you can, tarp the piles that you are going to burn, and wait until we get a rainy period. That's really important. Like you said, be aware of the machinery you're running, how the conditions are changing, and start asking yourself, hey, that inner voice is saying it's getting really hot and smelling some things. I should just stop right now. I can do this later. And it's important for your neighbors and your community and everybody in Alaska that you do it later, because when these fires do hit hard, they impact everybody, right? They impact our roads, they impact our businesses. There is a free brush disposal program in Alaska that's been growing because of the capital improvement program that has funded a lot of woody debris being accepted at landfills up and down the state. So please, wherever you are, whether you're remote or on the road system, check in to see if there's a free brush disposal program. The Matsu Palmer Central Landfill has a huge pile. Kenai has a huge pile, Delta Junction. So get those woody debris off your property in a safe manner in the back of your pickup or trailer and get them to somewhere where you don't have to worry about burning them at all.
All right. Well, thank you, Cale, for that. We are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about how to prevent wildfire this year as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People who smoke or have smoking-related conditions like lung and heart disease are more likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19. Not using any tobacco or e-cigarette products is one of the best ways to keep your immune system strong, ready to fight all kinds of viruses. If you decide to quit, help is available. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or text READY to 200-400 to get the support you need to quit for good. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the wildfire season. It is right now, so be extra careful when you're doing things outside to not inadvertently cause a fire to start. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation about how to prevent wildfire. 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Beth Ibsen, Public Affairs Specialist with the Bureau of Land Management for the Alaska Fire Service, is on the line with us, as is Cale Casey, the Public Information Officer for the Division of Forestry, and Monica Nicholson, who is a fuels expert with the BLM Fairbanks District Office. Beth, I wanted to ask you about a study that was published in April in a peer-reviewed journal called Science Advances. It was written by scientists with the Union of Concerned Scientists, Woodwell Climate Research Center, Tufts, and Harvard universities. They found that by mid-century, burned areas in Alaska and Canada are projected to increase by as much as 169%. And releasing the equivalent of 2.6 billion cars or 12 gigatons of carbon. The scientists say that fires in remote areas should also be managed to try to keep them nearer to historic levels. Is this part of the conversation at all? I know that Monica was just talking earlier about how, or maybe that was you, Beth, talking about how not suppressing fires in the lower 48 has, now all that built up fuel is being dealt with, and there's a return to more traditional types of burning in some areas. This study suggests that the opposite should be happening, that there should be more fire suppression to reduce emissions. How do you grapple with these competing concerns?
Yeah, certainly it's something that we weigh all the time. And fires have been happening before humans were around. And it's just a matter of how do we live with wildfires? And in Alaska, we have a very fire-dependent ecosystem where it's, you know, wildfire is part of a regeneration. So yes, that is definitely a tough one to juggle when you've got, you know, there's other impacts on the climate, and you have to weigh in with what the smoke and the carbon release is with associated with wildfires. So it's a constant juggle.
Mm-hmm. And this research also said that Alaska accounts for roughly 20% of burned land and half of U.S. fire emissions annually, yet only receives about 4% of federal fire management funding. So in light of the intense fires that we've seen in recent years down south, how challenging is that federal funding piece? This paper says that you need nearly $700 million more annually to keep fires at historic levels in Alaska. Sounds like an impossible task.
Well, first of all, you have to realize that Alaska is huge. We're one fifth the contiguous U.S.
Sure.
So, you know, that's going to be a great number. Plus, logistic challenges is going to add to the cost that number as well. So, I mean, we're quite a bit different in Alaska than the lower 48 for so many reasons. So it's hard to put a price tag on that. I'm not sure what they were looking at when they came up with that price tag, but a lot of our large fires happen in very remote areas. And, you know, it's, you know, as far as looking at the resources, you know, our priority is people and firefighter safety. So that is going to always be the number one priority. So when we do have a fire that is burning out in a remote area and is not threatening, you know, the values at there are no values at risk. And, you know, we are definitely going to prioritize that fires, those fires closer to communities over the ones that are burning in remote areas.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Andy is in Fairbanks. Hello, Andy.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. It's regarding individual preparedness. And you did stress the idea of trees around our houses and fuel importance and that kind of thing. You also mentioned accessibility to protect your house in case of a fire, mainly like a fire engine. How about suppression control? Some of us live in subdivisions up here where right now, especially during breakup, things have been a little bit wet. You couldn't get a fire engine in my subdivision. It would be impossible. What do we do about that? There's just no hope. That's a good question, and I'd like to just hear what the answer would be, actually.
All right. Beth or Kale, you want to?
Yeah, that's why we stress having not just defensible your home defensible, but having it survivable, because we have a lot of areas that are very remote and we may not be able to get to those locations in time. You know, you set a perfect example of it. So it's very important for homeowners, for property owners to have your property survivable to a wildfire instead of just defensible, because we may not be able to get to it in time.
And I could add on to that too, Beth. Encourage folks who are in those situations to work with their local city firefighting departments or their borough firefighting departments. They might have some really great ideas to help enhance access for those larger pieces of equipment. Also, the Alaska Division State of Forestry typically has smaller engines that can get into locations that are a little bit more difficult for larger vehicles, but both of those entities would be great folks to bring into your community, have them be involved, have them give you ideas, and then work with your neighbors to come up with a solution. It's really important.
All right. Well, thank you. That's great advice. Let's go quickly. We only have a few minutes left, but Jeff is an anchor point and has a question. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, then. Yeah, hello to everybody. I'll make it quick. Yeah, I was just wondering if those four-wheelers come from the factory with spark arresters on the mufflers. And then another quick thing is hopefully somebody's teaching the kids in our schools so they can go home and straighten the parents out. Thanks. And thanks to everybody fighting these fires.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. He's asking about spark arresters on ATVs. Is that standard or is that something that people have to add? Anyone have an idea about that?
Well, Lori, there are just so many different types of machines that folks are using in Alaska.
Sure.
We all know that not everybody has new anything. And so even if there were factory installed spark arresters, just the sheer variety of machinery out there, it's about human awareness. It's about us knowing what a machine can do. Parking on grass will start fire, and you have to report those immediately. That's really our big ask. If you do find yourself in a situation where you've totally inadvertently started a fire by accident, completely by accident, didn't realize it was going to happen, and it starts growing, please call right away so we can get initial attack moving. And then in terms of the school, we do have prevention officers throughout Alaska that do go into schools, and they've been really busy the last 6 weeks out of the Matsu area and out of the Kenai area, and the prevention officers set up school programs. They go in, they talk to the students, they hand out prevention materials, coloring books, crayons. They get them engaged at a young age. That's really important to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. In our final minute here, Monica, it was expensive. I had 8 spruce trees removed from my backyard here in Anchorage. They all were killed by beetles. For people who have acreage that and may have hundreds of dead standing trees, is there any assistance available for them?
Yes, there is, actually. And I will say, if you have a fields project or an activity that you'd like to do on your property or even at the community level, you can submit a proposal to a website, grants.gov, that's grants.gov. Typically, if you have a proposal submitted by the winter, we'll approve it before spring to approve federal funding for your project. Also, you can work with the Division of Forestry on some grants that they may have available and some programs such as the Good Neighbor Authority to help with matching funds or available funds. I'm not too familiar with the state side, but I do know they have a variety of programs that can help you achieve what you need to achieve on your property.
Spruce beetles were not a big concern farther north in past years, but is that changing now? Last year, Tim Mowry said that he was sent a photo of beetle-infested wood in Fairbanks. We don't know if it was, driven up there or not, but is that changing?
Yes, that is changing. It's quite noticeable. It's not in Fairbanks as prominently as it is in other parts of Alaska, but these things do spread and they spread at a rapid rate. And there have been several accounts, and we're very aware at the BLM that this problem is encroaching on interior Alaska, and it's definitely a consideration in everything we do.
All right. And in our final minute here, Kale and Beth, some quick ideas, suggestions for folks to just be careful and be safe when they're outside, especially as we're going to be seeing more tourists this summer than we have in a few years.
I guess it's mostly just don't leave your fire unattended later when more people are getting out and, going out camping and having that campfire. Is make sure that campfire is dead out, drown it in water, stir it, and make sure there's no hot coals underneath. And that's the biggest thing. It's just don't leave your fire unattended and, have fun. Have a safe fun time.
All right. Well, thank you so much to Beth Ibsen, Kale Casey. Earlier in the program, we heard from Eric Stevens, and also with us now is Monica Nicholson. Appreciate your help and all that you do to help keep Alaskans safe. Remember, everyone, to be careful. It's really dry out there in some parts of the state, so be very, very careful with your machinery and your activities outside. Thanks to our engineer, Tobin Shelby, our producer, Adlin Baxter, and on the phones and social media today, Kavitha George. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.